Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is
Sharon. Blog Talk Radio.
Who are this? Our show this evening. We have this evening Dr. Betty Knighton, who is going to share with us a lesson from the Gospel of John. Betty is the director of the Christian education at Pleasant Heights Church and administrator of Evangelical Bible Seminary. She enjoys lessons of life from all of the scriptures. Betty is going to talk to us about what does love have to do with it. Love has everything to do with it. She's going to walk us through the Gospel of John. She's going to make the gospel come real to every listener. She is going to share with us the depths of love God has for every man and mankind. I'm going to bring Betty on, and I would like to listen for you to listen intently. Thank you, Betty.
Good evening, Sharon. It is such a pleasure to be on this evening. And I will be sharing, as Sharon said, tidbits from the Gospel of John. John had lived long enough to see it all, from the very beginning all the way to the end. And as an adventuresome man, the idea of traveling around the wilderness of Judea with the other John appealed to him a great deal. So there are actually two Johns in the New Testament, John the Baptizer and the Apostle John. So the Apostle John left his very, very successful fishing business in the hands of his brother, and he took off to be with the other John. That's strange when that left a privileged status for a diet of locusts and wild honey. John wanted the chance to be with the other John when he prepared Israel for the coming of the Messiah. So one day, after being with John the Baptizer, he finally saw the Anointed One. But he didn't look like anything John expected him to look like. I mean, he thought he was going to be different, like come with royal robes, but he didn't. But he knew that this was the one. So he and another of John's disciples decided to get a closer look at him. And they followed him home to hear what he had to say about himself and Israel. And you know, before the dawn of the next day, he knew he had found the Messiah. Time he spent with Jesus just flew by in the beat of a lash, but it remained vividly clear in his mind for more than 70 years. And he wrote this gospel. Now, John is one of four gospels. Why do we need four gospels? Why were there four gospels? They're actually biographies of Jesus. But couldn't one have done the job? Well, why not two or three? Why not 12? We have four. And I will go through the four. But then they're not really four gospels. It's really one gospel from four perspectives. So let's just quickly review the other three. Matthew was a Jewish disciple of Jesus Christ, and he once earned his living as a tax collector, an official of the Roman government. But he was moved by the Spirit of God, so he wrote a biography of Jesus from a Hebrew point of view. So actually, Matthew directed his writings to the Jews. And then we have Mark. Now, Mark was not one of the 12 disciples. He was a son of a follower named Mary. And we can read about that in Acts 12:12. But Mark was a very close associate of Barnabas, Paul, and Peter. He presented Christ as minister from a practical, action-oriented point of view, in a narrative that frequently punctuated by the phrase, immediately. So this style really would have appealed to the can-do Romans of the first century, and that's actually who he directed this gospel to. This was written for the Romans, and his primary thing was the Son of God came to seek, serve, and save. So that was different from Matthew, whose primary thing was the Messiah has come. And then there's Luke. He was a physician and was probably born and reared in Macedonia. He was not a Jew. He was a Gentile. And he wrote to neither the spiritually privileged Jew nor the politically privileged Roman. He wrote to the common Greeks. And most of them had no power, they had no wealth, they had no hope. So Luke's gospel sort of highlighted the humanity of Jesus. He allowed them to see Jesus as a man. So he favored the title, Son of Man. And he talked about details about the humble birth and Jesus' ordinary boyhood and his compassion for the poor and the sick and the global scope of his ministry. So Luke's primary theme was the Son of Man came to redeem all of humanity. Now, those first three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, those are called the synoptic gospels because they have a similar point of view. But then you have that fourth gospel, John, the one we're going to be talking about. And John certainly knew of the other gospels, and he probably taught from them for many years before deciding, under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, and we should always be guided by the Holy Spirit, he decided that the biography of Jesus remained incomplete. You see, the Christian world knew Jesus as King of the Jews. They knew him as a servant. They knew him as the Son of Man. But there was one more need for the theme, Jesus as the Son of God. And that's where his focus is. He focuses on Jesus as deity, the Son of God. So he wrote his gospel so that we would know that the Son of Man is God in human flesh, completely human, yet completely God. So the Gospel of John provides no genealogy, like a couple of the other Gospels. So this illustrates the fact that deity has no beginning. You don't need to do a genealogy for something that does not have a beginning. The Gospel of John offers no childhood details. It retails no parables, perhaps to emphasize his transcendent nature as God. So the Gospel of John bypasses Jesus' temptation in the wilderness, and it doesn't talk about his transfiguration on the mountain and his commissioning the disciples after his resurrection and his ascension from earth. Instead, John writes from a philosophical and theological perspective. And he placed great emphasis on the miracles of Jesus, but he called them signs. This gospel is written to all believers. That's what it's written to. Now, for John, the miracles that he calls signs indicated a supernatural happening. And it was proof that what many considered to be theoretical truths were in fact real, and they were tangible. So the Word, and that's capital W, the Word had become flesh. All of humanity, every reason to believe, and to leave us no excuse for doubt. So his primary theme is the man we know as Jesus is none other than God. That's simply saying Christ is deity. You see, Matthew wrote, this is the Messiah, the King. Worship him. Mark wrote, this is a servant who serves humanity. Follow him. Luke wrote, this is the only man among men without sin. Emulate him. But John says, this is God in human flesh. Believe in him. So we're going to be talking about John and Christ being deity. And we know there were signs and there were discourses. But chapter 1 actually opens with the forerunner proclaiming the arrival of the Messiah and the baptism of Jesus, accompanied by the booming voice of the Father. And then in chapter 2, Jesus turns water into wine. And in chapter 4, he hears an official song. In chapter 5, he hears a paralyzed man. And in chapter 6, he feeds more than 5,000 men and their families. And then he walks across the surface of the Sea of Galilee. So we're going to be going into these, but right now we're going to go into verses 1 and 2. Now, verses 1 through 18 of the first chapter, we call it the prelude to deity. And I can recall as a second grader, in public school, believe it or not, we were given little tiny testaments of John. Very tiny little testament that you could hold in the palm of your hand. And we were asked by our teacher to memorize as many verses from the first chapter as we could. And I can remember standing in front of the class saying, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shined in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. There was a man sent from God, whose name was John. The same came from a witness to bear witness of the light, that all men through him might believe. He was not that light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which lighteth every man that cometh into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made by him, and the world knew him not. He came into his own, and his own received him not. But as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name, which were born not of blood, nor the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. I remember standing in front of the classroom reciting those verses. And it's just amazing to think back that there is nothing going on like that now in public school. You're not allowed to just do that in public school today, but that was a part of our training. It was a part of our reading. We were actually given those testaments in school. So we're starting out here with these verses. But let me just say this first. In 1964, there's a gentleman named Thayer Warshaw, and he was an English teacher at Newton High School near Boston. He was worried that when public schools banned the Bible, students would be deprived of an important part of their culture. So he wanted to make this point. So he devised a quiz. And he put on the quiz common allusions to Scripture, just as they appear in secular literature and language. And despite the fact that these children were in a top-rate, first-rate, exclusive school, the best there was, in spite of their obvious intelligence and first-rate education, the majority of these college-bound students couldn't complete the common expressions. And I'm going to give you the expression and tell you what percentage of the children could not complete the expression. First one, they shall beat their swords into blank. That's plowshares. But only 63% of the kids could not answer that question. The next one was, many are called, but few are. He had a blank there. And the word is chosen, but 79% couldn't answer that question. The next one was, the truth shall make you blank. Well, we know that's free, but 84% of those students didn't know that. And then he said, pride goes before a blank. Well, we know that's false. 88% of the students couldn't finish that sentence. And then it says, the love of money is the blank, 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 blank. We know that's the root of all evil. 93% of the students couldn't answer that question. And not only that, but several students at this nationally acclaimed school thought that Sodom and Gomorrah were lovers. And many named the four Gospels as Matthew, Mark, Luther, and John. And according to these same top-ranked students, Eve was created from an apple. Moses baptized Jesus. Jezebel was Ahab Duncan. Now, that's not far from the truth. And Jesus spoke in parables. Now, these were students from top-notch schools. So, the Apostle John wrote his account of Jesus' life to reveal the real identity of Jesus so that we might respond in belief. So that's why this gospel opens with the prologue in the first 18 verses, or the prologue. Prologue declares in bold, unambiguous terms that Jesus is none other than God in human flesh. And then John weaves this primary thesis through the rest of the narrative. Jesus claimed deity. His miracles supported his claim. His activities presupposed the truth, and his resurrection finally vindicated everything he said and did. So the prologue offers four reasons to believe that Jesus Christ is God. First one, Jesus Christ is eternal. He has no beginning, and he will have no end. And that's from the first two verses. Just as a reminder, the first two verses say, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. Now that tells us that he has no beginning, because that's like a circle. If you look at a circle, you can't tell where it starts, and you can't tell where it ends. It's just continuous. And then it says Jesus Christ is the creator. All things were made by him. It says as plain as day in verse 3, it says all things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. And then it goes on to say Jesus Christ is the source of life. Nothing remains alive apart from him. You find that in verse 1, 4 through 13. And then fourth statement, Jesus Christ, though completely human, fully reveals the Father. Jesus Christ is fully God, and he was fully man. So now, first two verses emphasize that Jesus Christ is eternal. He has no beginning, and he will have no end. And if you translate that literally, you would say, in beginning. You wouldn't say in the beginning. You would say in beginning. Okay? And when we say word, it's capital W. That's not a small letter word. Okay? So we have to be careful with that, because there are some translations, if you're not careful and you get the wrong translation, you will see some very subtle differences in the first verse of John from, say, the King James or the New International Version or the New King James or some of the other translations. But then if you look at the New World Translation, you will find some small letters there. You will even find a small letter G-God. Now, when you use a small letter G, God, you're saying that is not the God, that's a God. So that's downgrading who Jesus really is. So we have to be careful about the translations that we use. Now, this is very important, how you read this. The literal reading of John's first sentence is, in beginning was existing the Word, capital W. But why is it so important? Well, it's important because, you know, he chose his words carefully and he arranged them precisely because he didn't want any misunderstanding. He didn't want to leave any room for misunderstanding. And before any conceivable point in the eternal past, the Word, capital W, was already existing. So the Word, therefore, has no beginning because the Word has always existed. Now, it might be kind of difficult for us to wrap our minds around that concept. It's not always simple. Although people say John is the first gospel you should read because it's so simple and it's so easy to understand. Yes, it's simple in a sense, easy to understand in a sense, but in another sense, some concepts are complicated. It is a very profound gospel, okay? So now, later in the prologue, in verse 14, we learn that the Word is Jesus Christ. And that Greek term for that is logos. Now, that's a term that means word, but it was in existence 300 years before Christ. And what the word referred to, logos, it referred to an uncreated divine mind that gives meaning and order to the universe. So John basically co-opted the concept, borrowed the word, saying in effect the concept pagan philosophers, because that's who used it long before the time of Christ, the concept pagan philosophers have theorized actually exists. He is God and Jesus Christ is he. So we can wrap our minds around that, we'll be doing okay. Now, he continues to describe the word by saying he was with God. Now, there's another Greek word that comes into play here. It's P-R-O-S, pros, the Greek proposition pros. And when you use it in this way, it represents familiarity. So the word, capital W, and God the Father were existing close together, sharing place and sharing intimacy and purpose. In fact, when you think about it, the intimacy and familiarity was such that the Word was God. You get that? The Word was God. So the Word and God share the same essence. Therefore, all that is true of God is true of the Word. Now, we need to take a look at Psalm 90 here. And this came from the pen of Moses, not David. It came from the pen of Moses. It says, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. And that's the first and second verses of Psalm 90. Now, one more Greek word here. This is a Hebrew word here. For everlasting is olam, O-L-A-M. And it's probably derived from a similar word meaning to hide. Because if you take an object and you keep moving it further and further away from the observer, pretty soon it's going to vanish from sight. It's going to be beyond the vanishing point. So a good paraphrase would render the idea this way. From the vanishing point in the past to the vanishing point in the future, you have existed, Lord. That's basically what that psalm is saying. Now, let's take a look at verse 3. And verse 3 says again, all things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. So, that's saying that Jesus Christ is the creator, and all things were made by him. John has stated that the Word is deity. And he goes on to make his case from the standpoint of time. Only God is eternal. And that bears repeating. Only God is eternal. And because the word, capital W again, is eternal, he is God. So now in verse 3, the apostle establishes the deity of Christ from another perspective, creation. There are some who would say that, oh yes, Jesus was a man of history. He was a good prophet, excellent rabbi, but he's not deity. Well, I beg to differ because the word says right here, he was with God, he was God, okay? So, let's look at 4 through 8, okay? And it really tells us in those verses, 4 through 8, that Jesus Christ is the source of life and that nothing remains alive apart from him. Because it says in verse 4, in him was life, and the life was the light of men. Now, John's gospel does something that the other three gospels don't, the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, okay? Matthew traced Christ's genealogy back to Abraham. Luke traced his roots to the first human, Adam. But John goes beyond the physical creation to state that in Jesus Christ was life and light. Two images there, life and light. Moses used those in reference to God in Genesis. First of all, when you use that in Genesis 1, because the Creator spoke the universe into existence. Can you imagine? He spoke it into existence. And then he filled it with the light of his truth. So then the Creator began filling the earth with life. After he filled it with light, he starts filling it with life. So there are your two images there, life and light. He put vegetation and sea creatures and birds and land animals, and then his crowning achievement, humanity. He breathed his own life into the man and the woman, and together they bore his image. So what John is saying in effect is, in the beginning, God the Son created humanity and filled them with life. And then he came to earth as a human to bring life again to humanity, which was spiritually dead because of sin. And that's why he had to come. So while it's true that John did not specifically mention the fall of humanity, which is in Genesis 3, we're safe in assuming that by the end of the first century, that doctrine of human depravity was well understood by most people. So John did highlight our desperate need for salvation, though, because he described the world's reaction to the appearance of life and light. He talked about how we didn't acknowledge the light, okay? So John said, declared that the darkness of the world did not, and I'm going to give you a Greek word here, katalambano, K-A-T-A-L-A-M-B-A-N-O. The world did not katalambano the light. So this Greek word has a range of meanings, depending on the context, and therefore it has no direct English equivalent. We can't translate this directly into English, but the primary meaning, as close as we can come, is to seize, attack, overpower, or hold without losing grip. So, as it happens so often in language, when you can't do a direct translation, the literal definition eventually led to its metaphorical use, meaning to comprehend or understand. In there where it says the light shines in darkness and the darkness comprehended it not, that Greek word will fit right in there, okay? Katalambano. So this could be a double entendre, though, but you know, both literal and figurative. Because in the end, darkness could not suppress the light, even by placing the light, capital L, in a tomb. We know what happened when Jesus was placed in the tomb. Jesus was the light of the world. Did that make the light go out by placing him in a tomb?
No, it did not. They couldn't really extinguish the light. Now, the verses that follow appear to stress the mental deficiency of the darkness. It's unwillingness to believe. It didn't want to believe. It didn't want to understand. But as the story of Jesus unfolds, John will show that truth is nonsense to a mind that's darkened by sin. Sin doesn't want to see the light. The light is given to us, but we have to accept the light. If I want to live in a dark house, I have access to light, electricity. But if I want to live in a dark house, that's my choice. If I don't want to live in a dark house, I can flick the light switch. There were some people who didn't want to comprehend the light. They were fine living in sin as they were, okay? Now, John the Baptizer, the one that John the Apostle wanted to hang out with, he called Jesus the greatest of all the prophets, okay? And that's in Matthew 11, 9 through 13. Jesus was one who had no match. Nobody could match him. The darkness had no match for him. Now, there were some great prophets. We had Moses, Samuel, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, all the luminaries of the word throughout the centuries before him. Some of them failed to enlighten humanity, but they were only human. The only hope for mankind was the source of the light. That's why Jesus had to come. He can illumine every mind because he's more than human. He was fully man, but he's fully God. So if we look at verses 9 through 13, that was the true light. Jesus was the true light. We know that. Which light is every man that cometh into the world. Now, when you look at that at a first glance, it might be a little troublesome. It might seem like it's trying to contradict what John had just declared in verse 5. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness didn't understand it. But if you read on, John's point becomes clearer. Because now that the source of light had come to earth and has illumined the minds of humanity, no one can claim ignorance. Now you know, you can't say, well, I didn't know. So all who do not believe are without excuse. You have no excuses now. The facts are known. The truth is known. Now what's your excuse for still sinning? The light has come. The light has revealed itself. In John 15, it says, and this is before his arrest, this is what Jesus told his disciples. He said, if I had not come and spoken to them, they would not have sinned. But now they have no excuse for their sin. He who hates me hates my Father also. And if I had not done among them the works which no one else did, they would not have sinned. But now they have both seen and heard me, and my Father as well. But they have done this to fulfill the word that is written in their law. They hated me without a cause. Now that's about as far as we're going to get this evening. We will have to leave you. But we are going to continue this next week. And hopefully we will go as far as the beginning of chapter 2. So, thank you for listening. It has been a pleasure sharing this word with you from John. Taryn?
Thank you, Betty Knighton. Excellent show. Our hearts burned with the information that you gave us. We appreciate it, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Good night.